Chapter 13. The Invaders. In the 4 decades following the Larkin Antelopes' last football championship, 1928 to 1968, that little oil town witnessed many changes, as did the state. In World War II, Texas fighting men performed with customary valor. One native son, Dwight D. Eisenhower, was leading the Allied armies to victory in Europe, while another, Chester W. Nimitz, was doing the same with the fleet in the Pacific. And still another, Ira Aker, was sending his 8th Air Force planes to devastate Nazi military production. One tough little Texas GI, Audie Murphy, was so eager to get into combat that he lied about his age and won so many medals that he leaned forward when he walked. Equally important was the emergence of Texas politicians as powers in Washington, because previous Texans with leadership possibilities had usually seen Texas politics as more important than national. For example, John Reagan, Postmaster General of the Confederacy and one of the very greatest Texans, had served in the National Congress for many years and was a United States Senator when an appointment to the Texas Railroad Commission opened in 1891. Without hesitation, he surrendered his Senate seat to help regulate this important aspect of Texas life, apparently in the belief that what happened in Texas was what really mattered. Under the principles laid down by his prudent leadership, this commission became the arbiter not only of railroads, so essential to the state's development, but eventually also of trucks, utilities, and particularly the oil business, including the transport in pipelines of petroleum products to the rest of the country. Insofar as his career was concerned, Texas was more important than the nation. This provincialism denied Texas the voice in national affairs to which it was entitled. But now, a trio of ornery, capable, arm-twisting Democratic politicians came on the scene to become three of the most capable public servants our nation has had. In 1931, Cactus Jack Garner became Speaker of the House of Representatives in Washington, and soon after, a powerful Vice President. In 1940, Sam Rayburn became one of the most effective Speakers of the House, a job he held, with two short breaks, till his death in 1961. And tall, gregarious, and able Lyndon Johnson became a Congressman, later Majority Leader of the Senate, then Vice President, and finally, on the 22nd of November 1963, in an airplane standing on Love Field in Dallas, the 36th President of the United States. Coincident with these accomplishments in war and politics, Texas surged to the fore in another aspect of American life, which sometimes seemed to have equal importance. Motion pictures of striking originality and power began to depict life in Texas in such a compelling way that the grandeur and the power of the state had to be recognized. Audiences by the millions swarmed to see movies like Giant, The Alamo, and the various John Wayne cowboy epics, especially the excellent Red River. Other good westerns involved Texas in no specific way, but did help keep alive the legend. Cimarron, 1931, Stagecoach, 1939, The Oxbow Incident, 1943, High Noon, 1952, Shane, 1953, and the film of his which Wayne preferred above all others, The Searchers, 1956. Even in faraway Italy, the spaghetti western created an alluring vision of the West, and Texas reaped the benefit. The state was seen as heroic, colorful, and authentic. Its men were tall, its women beautiful, its longhorns compelling. Even its Mexican villains displayed uniqueness, if not charm, and each year the legend grew. Of course, there were disadvantages. Many thoughtful people in other parts of the nation began to resent this emphasis on Texas and saw the state as a haven for broken-down cowboys, rustlers, and prairie misfits, men who treated Indians, Mexicans, and women with contempt. Jokes about Texas braggadocio became popular. One of the most imaginative concerning the Connecticut River expert, who was hired by Dallas to determine whether the Trinity River could be deepened so as to give the city shipping access to the sea. "Very simple," the engineer said. "Dig a canal from Dallas to the Gulf, and if you characters can suck half as hard as you blow, you'll have a river here in no time. Thousands of Americans developed a love-hate relationship with the state, with the love predominating. And starting in the mid-60s, citizens in what Texans called the less favored parts of our nation began to drift toward Texas, attracted by the myth, the availability of good jobs, the pleasant winter climate, and the relaxed pattern of life. Men wrote to friends back in Minnesota, "Down here, I can wear the same outfit winter and summer." To appreciate the various ways in which the magnetic attraction of Texas could be exerted, it is necessary to understand the related cases of Ben Talbot and Eloy Muskis. Neither was born in Texas, yet each came to treasure it as a home he did not wish to leave. Talbot was tall and thin, a reticent man born in northern Vermont close to the Canadian border. And since his father had served for many years as a U.S. Border Patrol officer, checking the movement of Canadians south from Montreal, he too decided to apply to the service after graduating from the University of Vermont in 1944. Instead, the son was tapped by Selective Service for the Army and sent to the South Pacific, where on steaming Bougainville up the slot from Guadalcanal, he vowed that if he got out alive, he would never again live in a hot climate. "Vermont for me." And on sweltering nights, lying beneath his mosquito net, bathed in sweat, he thought of his father's cold assignment along the Canadian border. When he returned to the States, he found that his military duty in a hardship post had given him so many credits that the Immigration and Naturalization Service was almost forced to accept him. But after he had been sworn in, with his father watching in approval, Talbot Sr. told his son, "Ben, work hard in the Spanish school, master the language, and serve your obligatory stretch along the Mexican border. We all had to learn Spanish and do our tour down there. But do everything you can, pull every trick in the book to get assigned back here for your permanent duty." "I intend to." The Spanish teacher in the academy despaired of ever teaching Talbot a word of that mellifluous language, for his flat Vermont drawl caused him to pronounce every word in a high nasal wail, with equal emphasis on each syllable. "Mañana" came out "ma-na-na," no tilde, as if each group of letters was personally repugnant. And he pronounced longer words like "fortaleza," as if the syllables were a chain of connected boxcars bumping slowly down a track. "Candidate Talbot," the instructor pleaded, "don't you ever sing words when your heart is joyous?" And he replied, "I sing hymns, words I speak." But because of his studious mastery of vocabulary and his skill in putting those words together in proper sentences, his teacher had to concede, "Talbot, you speak Spanish perfectly, but it isn't Spanish." "They'll understand," Ben countered. And when he reached his indoctrination assignment at El Paso and began apprehending illegal Mexican aliens trying to sneak into the country, the wetbacks did understand when he interrogated them, for he spoke very slowly, like a machine running down, and enunciated each of his Vermont-style syllables clearly. Older officers would listen in amazement to the sounds which came from his lips and watch with sly grins as the Mexican listening to them gazed in wonder. But slowly, after about his third question, a light would suffuse the Mexican face as the alien realized that the tall man with the severe frown was speaking Spanish. Often the captive would gush out answers in relief at having solved the mystery, so the Talbot proved quite effective. At the end of his training, his superior reported, "Ben looks so stiff and forbidding and speaks such horrible Spanish that he starts by terrifying the men he interrogates. But when they see the sympathy in his eyes and listen to the slow, careful way he pronounces each syllable, I think they feel sorry for him. At any rate, he gets better results than most." His avowed plan of doing well along the border so that he might return to the more pleasant duty along the Canadian frontier received its first slight tremor when he was assigned to the duty station at Las Cruces, up the line in New Mexico. He had been there only a few weeks when he realized that he wanted rather strongly to be back in El Paso. That's where the real work goes on. He was not homesick for the place, and certainly not for the food or the heat. But he did miss the teeming vitality of that bilingual town, with Ciudad Juarez across the river, and he must have conveyed his feelings to his superiors, because after 6 months of chasing illegals through the brush of New Mexico, he was reassigned to El Paso, and there began the long years of his service. His childhood days in the Vermont woods had enabled him to master the tricks of tracking, and to him the traces of all animals, including man, told a clear story. He could look at a dry riverbank around El Paso and determine how many Mexicans had made it across during the night, their approximate ages by the patterns of their shoes, whether he was seeing the signs of a group or merely an accumulation of many singles, and where they were probably heading. He was uncanny in predicting, or as he said, making a wishbone guess, as to where these fugitives would intersect some main road, and often, when they appeared, he would be there awaiting them. He never abused a Mexican he captured. Calling them all Juan, which he pronounced as if it were Juan, he talked with them patiently, offered them coffee or a drink of cold water, and shared his sandwiches, explaining in his ox-like Spanish that they would not be mistreated, but that they must be sent back home. Of course, once they were back across the Rio Grande, they would probably turn around and come north again. That was understood by all. Nothing deterred them, not the clever detective work of Border Patrol Officer Talbot, nor the formal checkpoints along the highways, nor the surveillance airplanes that flew overhead, nor the dangers involved in running across a rocky yard and jumping onto a moving Southern Pacific freight train headed east. They came alone, in pairs, in well-organized groups of 18 or 20, and in casual hundreds. They were part of that endless chain of Mexican peasants who left their homeland in search of employment in a more affluent country. How many crossed the river illegally? Thousands upon thousands. How many were caught? Perhaps only 10 or 15%. But if dedicated men like Ben Talbot had not been working diligently since the Border Patrol was first established in 1924, the flood northward would have been 3 times as great. In early 1960, Talbot sent a well-reasoned report to his superiors, stating that in his opinion, more than 2 million illegal Mexican aliens had crept into the United States in the preceding decade, and that there appeared to be no diminution of the flood. The pressures which send them north—poverty, the cruel indifference of their government, the maldistribution of wealth in a wealthy country, and the awful pressures of population growth which both church and government encourage—show no signs of being brought under control. So we must expect an unending continuation of the present inflow, and must begin to study what it will mean when the southern part of Texas becomes a de facto Hispanic enclave. He ended his report with 2 revealing paragraphs. The gravity of the situation is exemplified by the case of one Eloy Musquiz, citizen of Zacatecas, 850 miles to the south. 31 years old, perpetually smiling, and apparently a good citizen, whether in Mexico or the United States, he leaves his home in Zacatecas every winter about the 10th of February, travels by bus to Ciudad Juarez, crosses the Rio Grande illegally, either evades me or is captured by me. If I catch him, I send him back to Mexico, and that afternoon he recrosses the river and eludes me. He hops a freight, heads east to where I do not know, works in Texas till the 15th of December, when he reappears in El Paso heading south. Since he is then leaving the States, we let him go. He returns by bus to his home in Zacatecas, plays with his sons, gets his wife pregnant once more, and on the 12th of February is back in Ciudad Juarez trying to break through our lines. He always succeeds. And just before Christmas, we see him with that perpetual smile, walking briskly along and wishing us a Merry Christmas as he heads home. Eloy Musquiz is our perpetual problem. One other thing. I should like to withdraw my application for reassignment to the Vermont-Canada border. I have now learned colloquial Spanish and feel a growing affection for El Paso and its problems. I would like to continue my duty on the Texas-Mexico border." He was accurate in every statement he made about Musquis, but there were a few crucial facts which the persistent Mexican worker had succeeded in keeping hidden. He did smile all the time, even when captured at the railway yards, and he was a good citizen in both his countries. He did go home each Christmas to be with his family, and he judged his visit successful if he left his wife pregnant. His daughter and two sons were each born in September. He did invariably move east by hopping a Southern Pacific freight, and he did reappear in El Paso about the 15th of December each year with a somewhat larger roll of American $50 bills, which he would deliver to his wife in Zacatecas. It was the long period from the 12th of February to the 15th of December that remained a blank in Ben Talbot's records. In 1961, for example, Musquis came north to Ciudad Juarez on schedule, and as always, he went to a Mexican grocery, where he filled his small canvas backpack with the staples required for the trip northeast. Two small cans of sardines, six limes, four cans of apricots with lots of juice, two very important cans of refried beans, and a large bag of the one essential for an excursion into the United States, pinole, a mixture of parched corn, roasted peanuts, and brown sugar, all ground to the finest possible texture. When mixed with water, it produced a life-sustaining beverage, but it could also be eaten dry, and then it was more tasty than candy. As Eloy told the woman shopkeeper, "Four pinches of pinole keeps you moving for a whole day. A bag like this, it could carry me to Canada." With all items packed according to what he had learned on seven previous trips, he left the store casually at about 1 in the afternoon, walked down to the dry riverbed, watched for an appropriate time when the immigration officers were occupied with three Mexicans they had caught, and slipped into the United States. Working his way cautiously eastward, he came upon the familiar freight yards of the Southern Pacific, where he hid beside a line of stationary boxcars, peeking out to watch the freight engines shunt long lines of laden boxcars before they started on the cross-Texas trip to San Antonio and on to Houston. That was the train he would be catching within a few hours, and during the waiting period, he reminded himself of safety precautions he had accumulated on various trips. Remember, if it should rain in the next hour, don't try. Let the train ride off without you. That was how Elizondo lost his legs, slipping on mud. Remember, if it should be rocky where you make your jump, let the train go. That's how Gutierrez died, tripping and falling under the wheels. Remember, keep your hands clear of the coupling. That's how Cortinas lost his left hand when the engine stopped suddenly. And remember, if the car you land in has cargo that can shift, get out, even if you have to jump. When the marble blocks shifted sideways, they crushed Alarcón, didn't they? And when that cargo of grain broke loose, it smothered Salcedo, didn't it? On the freight trains east, death was a constant companion, and it was prudent to wedge a block in the sliding doors to keep them from slamming irrevocably shut. Once 40 were trapped in a freight car, which had to lay over in a blinding Texas blizzard. All froze to death. In another instance, 37 died from the stifling heat, which reached 140 degrees. At 2:10 on this February day, Eloy Musquis watched the freight forming with the greatest concentration, calculating his line of approach, and trying to identify some car in which it would be relatively safe to ride. At 2:20, he adjusted his bundle, grasping the strings at the bottom and securing them about his waist so that his groceries would not bounce about as he ran. At 2:25, the engineer sounded his whistle, and the first straining of the heavy wheels occurred. As long as the train remained stationary, the wetbacks dared not board, since the border patrol would pick them off. But once the boxcars started forward, there would be a general rush, in which so many Mexicans dashed for the train The guards had no chance to intercept everyone. Now, as the train lurched forward in sudden jolts, Eloy and some 70 other men, looking like a horde of ants rushing toward some fallen morsel, made a wild dash for the boxcars and the metal framework under them. Muskies, easily in the lead, was about to reach the cars when the tall, thin figure of Ben Talbot stepped out from behind his own hiding place to intercept him and two others. There were two rules in the El Paso game. It was widely known that American officers would not treat their captives brutally, and it was understood that no Mexican fugitive would strike or fire at an immigration officer. It was a relentless struggle, carried on through all the hours of a day, but it was honorable. And now, when Talbot grabbed the three Mexicans, it was as if they had been playing a friendly game of touch football. They stopped trying to run. Talbot said, "Okay, compadres," and Eloy looked up at him, smiled as if they were brothers, and walked calmly into captivity. He was led to a clearing station, documented for the eighth time, and returned once more to Ciudad Juarez, where, without even changing stride, he walked to the river, crept across when no one was patrolling, made his way to the railroad yards, and headed for the next freight, which hauled more than 150 boxcars. With customary skill, his bundle tied close to his back, he sped across the yard, calculated his leap, and made his way into a boxcar filled with freight that was safely lashed down. The Border Patrol in El Paso always assumed that Muskies remained aboard the train to San Antonio, losing himself in that growing metropolis where Spanish-speaking citizens were commonplace. And Officer Talbot had sent inquiries to that city, asking immigration people there to be on the lookout for Eloy. But Muskies was too clever to act in so predictable a manner. When the freight train stopped for water in Fort Stockton, 245 miles to the east, he remained hidden for 20 minutes, knowing that La Migra, the immigration people, would be chasing the men who jumped off right away. When this did happen, with him watching the frantic game from a peephole, he casually dropped down from the boxcar and sauntered across the yard to a rusted Ford station wagon that had stood beside a deserted road for years. Opening the creaking door carefully lest it fall off, he crept inside, pulled the door shut behind him, and went to sleep. The fourth time in 4 years he had done this. At dusk, with the train long gone for its destination in Houston, Eloy started walking up the familiar road to Monahans, Odessa, Midland, and Lubbock. He covered many of the 223 miles on foot, caught a few hitches, turned down job offers from two different ranchers, and paid American dollars for the bus ticket which carried him from Midland to Lubbock. At the station in the former city, a well-dressed woman asked if he needed work, and was obviously disappointed when he said no. As he neared Lubbock on its unbelievably flat plain, his heart expanded, for now he was on land he knew and loved. Nodding to several acquaintances in the bus station, he assured them that when summer came he would again tend their lawns. But then he started walking west on Highway 114, and before long a rancher who recognized him carried him on to Leveland, where, with his usual broad smile, he bade the man goodbye and headed for the customary cotton gin, where he reported to the foreman of the idle plant. "I'm back." "Where are you working till we start our run?" "Mr. Huckaday," he asked. "Good man. But come August 1st, we want you here." "I'll be here." That year, he had 14 different jobs. Everyone he met sought his help, for he was known throughout the community as reliable, congenial, and the father of three children down in Zacatecas, to whom he sent 9/10 of his wages. He did yard work. One woman of considerable wealth arranged for him to get a driver's license, strictly illegal, so that he could chauffeur her about. He worked at stores, cleaning up after midnight. And he did occasional babysitting for young couples. By 1968, Muskies had become a fixture at a local cotton gin, supervising the machinery. And as December approached, he went to see the owner of the installation. Before he had spoken 6 words, he broke into tears. When the owner asked in Spanish what the matter was, Eloy handed him a letter from his oldest boy. Signora Muskis, Eloy's stalwart wife, who had run their family without a man, had died, leaving the three children motherless. Dear trusted friend, this is a tragedy. My heart goes out to you. Señor, if I bring my children north with me, could you find them work? How would you get them here? I get here, don't I? Señor, I love Lubbock. I love Texas. This is my home now. Any rancher in Texas would want a man like you. If they're good children. They are. Their mother saw to that. Suddenly, it was the owner who was sniffling. We'll find a place. Here's some money for your trip. As Eloy stepped off the bus in El Paso, he found Ben Talbot waiting for him, and he supposed that he was going to be arrested. And the tall officer, who spoke the peculiar Spanish, took him by the arm, led him to a bar, and said, over Dr. Pepper's, Eloy, the big man has given me hell. Says I let you come in and out of the country as if you owned it. He wants you arrested. General Talbot, Muskis called every officer general in either Mexico or Texas, for he had learned that such an error produced few reprisals. You must not arrest me. My wife has died. After Talbot studied the sweat-stained letter, he blew his nose and delivered his warning. Eloy, go back to Zacatecas. Take care of your children, and don't come up this way again, because next time I catch you, the big boss insists you go to jail. But I must come back, General Talbot, and I must bring my children. Damn it, Eloy, there is no way you can sneak past us with three kids. You'll be caught, and into the calaboose you go. Then what will happen to your children? General Talbot, we must come back. We are needed. That was the haunting phrase which put this border problem into perspective. The Mexicans who were streaming across in such uncounted numbers were mostly illiterate, and they showed no inclination toward becoming Americanized, as immigrants from Europe had done in the early 1900s. Instead, they clung to their Spanish language and their Mexican ways, and there were 50 other things wrong with them. But they were needed. They were needed by ranchers who could not otherwise find cowboys, and by young mothers who could not find helpers. They were needed in restaurants and hotels and shops, and in almost every service activity engaged in by the people of Texas. They were desperately needed, and as long as this was true, they would be enticed over the border by the millions. As the 12th of February, 1969, approached, Border Patrol Officer Talbot, who now wore cowboy boots, a large hat, and a bolo tie when off duty, and could scarcely remember when he had been a Vermonter, realized that his old friend and nemesis, Eloy Muskis, was due to make his appearance in Ciudad Juarez in preparation for his dash to paradise, this time with three children in tow. So he telephoned a Mexican officer in Juarez with whom he had established good relations and asked, You see a man about 40 years old, with three kids, buying groceries for a dash across? No, but I'll keep watch. And after a while, the Mexican called back. Yep, buying sardines, canned refried beans, canned fruit juices, and a big bag of pinole. Let me know when he crosses. As if obedient to some inner schedule, one which had worked in the past, at about 1 p.m, Eloy led his three children across the dry river and eastward toward the freight yards. From a distance, Talbot, marking their progress through field glasses, saw the father instruct his children as to how they must run to leap aboard the moving freight. He saw the engine getting up steam, the surreptitious movement of illegals edging toward the still motionless boxcars, and he could feel the tension. Then, to his dismay, almost his horror, he saw that his fellow officer Dan Carlisle had spotted Eloy and his children and was placing himself in position to nab them within the next few minutes. Without hesitation, he activated his walkie-talkie. 303, 202 calling. I'm on to a crowd that might prove difficult. 303 speaking. Cannot help, following my own crowd. Could be I'll need help. You want me to come over? You'd better. With relief, he saw Carlyle stop his tracking of the Muskies family and start west. When he reaches here, I'll think of some explanation. With his glasses, he watched the engineer climb aboard the diesel, saw the trainmen wigwag their signals, and studied carefully the long line of boxcars as it strained to get started. Wheels spun, the engines coughed, the cars started to inch forward. Another spin, then all the wheels seemed to catch at the same instant, and the long train began to pick up speed. Almost trembling, he watched as Muskies started his three children for the boxcars, urging them forward. "Christ in heaven," Talbot prayed, "don't let them slip." And he watched with strange satisfaction as the two boys leaped for the train, grasping the proper handholds. Now the little girl, 12 years old, had to make the flying leap. And Talbot watched, teeth clenched, as her father spurred her on, her long dress flapping in the February sunlight. "Faster, kid," Talbot cried under his breath. And he sighed with relief when he saw Eloy lift her and almost throw her toward the train, where her brothers dragged her to safety. "Okay, Muskies." He gasped, for at this moment one of the many scrambling wetbacks slipped and fell toward the implacable wheels which had destroyed so many in such situations. Was it Muskies? Talbot saw the sliding man frantically clutch at rocks, until with bleeding fingers he caught one that saved him, and there he lay as the train moved past, its wheels turning always faster. Eloy, leaping over the fallen man, grabbed the handholds, swung himself into the boxcar, and disappeared. At the Fort Stockton stop, Muskies explained to his children why they must wait till the first frenzied action dissipated. Then quietly, he led them to the rusted Ford station wagon that still stood beside the road. In it, they slept for some hours, side by side, waking when it was time to head cautiously for Midland, where they caught the bus to Lubbock. When they reached Leveland, they were greeted with warmth and even embraces, for many families needed their help. When they were safe in the two-room shack which the plantation owner provided, Muskies told his children, "This is our home now. We will never leave." If Ben Talbot developed a feeling of brotherhood toward Eloy Muskies because of the latter's decency and courage, he knew another Mexican for whom he felt only loathing. And this slimy operator preoccupied his attention both when Talbot was on the job or resting beside the swimming pool at the house he and his wife Maria Luz had built at the edge of El Paso. His notes on this infamous man explained why he despised him. El Lobo, real name unknown, birthplace unknown. Frequents the Cantina El Azteca. About 32, slight, neatly trimmed mustache, toothpick in corner of mouth. Always present when some deal is being engineered. Never present when trouble starts. Stays in Ciudad Juarez mostly, but is willing to come boldly into El Paso when business requires it. Occupation? Coyote. Smuggles groups of wetbacks to rendezvous in the desert. Collects his fee, and often deserts them. 1. Locked 63 wetbacks into a closed truck with space for 16 at most. Drove across desert to Van Horn in blazing heat. More than 20 died. 2. Dropped 17 wetbacks into the small opening of a tank car that had been carrying gasoline. Closed the hatch at El Paso Yards. All dead when hatch opened at Fort Stockton. 3. Packed 22 into a Chevrolet, plus 2 locked in the trunk. In order to protect springs on car, wedged wooden posts between them and body. Friction from driving set wood on fire. He ran from car, but did not stop to open trunk. 2 men incinerated. 4. On at least 2 occasions, led groups of girls who wanted to be waitresses across the desert and sold them to the men from Oklahoma City. Talbot vowed that he would catch this evil man during some foray north of the river, but El Lobo was so clever and self-protective that he could not be trapped, and often Talbot had to watch with disgust as the slim, tricky fellow came boldly into El Paso on the maternity gambit, leading some pregnant peasant girl to Thomason General Hospital, and charging her a fee for the service. Since El Lobo broke no law during such missions, and since the deaths listed on his dossier could not be proved against him, he moved with impunity. But events were about to unfold in a dusty little town well south of the border, which would place him in real jeopardy. On the bleak and sandy plains of northern Mexico, midway between the cities of Chihuahua and Ciudad Juarez, stood the adobe village of Moctezuma, seven small huts, one of which served as a roadside shop, dispensing allegedly cold drinks to American motorists. The place was called by the grandiloquent name La Tienda del Norte and was operated by the Guzmans, a widowed woman with two daughters and a son. The older girl was married to the man who ran the nearby Pemex station, and it was her responsibility to wash the windshields of any cars that stopped and to send orders to the national gasoline monopoly for such additional supplies as her husband thought he might sell to motorists who found themselves short of gas on this rather frightening road. If one did not fill up at Moctezuma, one could well be stranded before reaching Chihuahua. It was this constant flow of big cars passing south that caused discontent in the little village. For when one stopped for either gas or a cold drink, the Mexicans could see the wealth the owners possessed. "They are all richer than the Archbishop. It must be fun to live in Los Estados Unidos, where money is so easy." The young wife, Euphemia, had often thought of this as she tended the rich travelers, but more so now that she was pregnant. Her condition occasioned great discussion among the residents of Moctezuma, for what a young woman did when she was pregnant made a universe of difference, as two of the older women reminded the mother, Encarnacion. "It is important. It is life and death, really, that you get her to El Paso." "True, but neither her husband nor any of his friends have done this thing, and they have no way of instructing her." "What you must do," one of the women said, "is get her to Juarez and put her in touch with my cousin, El Lobo, that's his name, and his job is to slip people into the States." The other woman had a simpler plan. "To get into El Paso is nothing. You just walk across the bridge. But to leave El Paso for the rest of the States, that's when you need El Lobo." "You think that Euphemia can just go to Juarez, cross over, and reach Thomas and General without getting caught?" "Others have done it, haven't they?" And that was the nagging fact. Other pregnant women from villages far off the main road had somehow reached Juarez, got across the river, and entered the hospital, had their babies, and come home with that precious piece of paper, more valuable than gold, which certified that this child, male or female, and of such and such a name, had been born within the United States. Such a paper meant that for as long as he or she lived, that child could enter the States, assume his citizenship, get a free education, and build a good life. Without such a certificate, life would almost certainly be one of unending poverty in northern Mexico. Therefore, women like Euphemia were willing to undergo any hardships to ensure that their unborn children received a fair start in life. And that was why even the poorest, even the least educated, headed for El Paso in their ninth month. But these benefits did not fully explain why so many citizens of Moctezuma yearned to live in the States. Nothing differentiated their land from that of New Mexico or Arizona, and it was actually better than many parts of West Texas. The strain of people was no different from that of people who prospered in those American states, and the climate was the same. But the sad fact was that in Mexico, no way had been devised whereby the unquestioned wealth of the land, almost unequaled in the Americas, could be justly distributed. The wealthy grew immensely wealthy. The Guzmans could see the great cars sweeping north to the shops across the Rio Grande, and then come roaring back, loaded with goods purchased in American stores. But in the Mexican system, none of that wealth filtered down to the peasants who did most of the work. Indeed, it would be difficult to find a more cynical system than that which trapped Encarnacion Guzman and her three children. For the national leaders had been preaching since the 1920s the triumph of La Revolución, and each succeeding administration had cried at election time, "Let us march forward with la revolución." But the same reactionary cadre had remained in power, cynically stealing the nation's wealth and allowing the great masses of the people to plod along, sometimes at the starvation level. Any young person living in Moctezuma would try to get to the States. And if a pregnant woman wanted to ensure that her baby was born with rights to that superior economic system, she was entitled to try every known device to accomplish it. The flood of people streaming north never seemed to diminish. The plan that the Guzmans worked out was this. Brother Candido, a clever 17-year-old, would take his sister Euphemia to Juarez, where he would make contact with El Lobo. And for a small fee, which Candido would carry in his shoe, Euphemia would be taken across the bridge 2 or 3 days before her labor was supposed to begin. She would be kept in a house run by El Lobo's friends. And on the morning when birth seemed imminent, she would be taken to a place close to the hospital. At the proper time, and this would be crucial, but women in the area could help determine it, she would be rushed as an emergency patient to the hospital, where she would give birth, she hoped, to a son. Then her friends would show her how to acquire a birth certificate and purchase 3 or 4 photographed copies. She would then recross the bridge, rejoin her brother, and return to Moctezuma. And 18 years later, she would bid her son goodbye when he left to take up residence in the States.